days earlier.
Not in the last 7 days, no,
Harry said.
Look, part of the trick of doing the impossible is being selective about which impossibilities you challenge, and only trying when you have a special advantage. If there's a money-making method in this book that sounds difficult for a wizard, but it's easy if we can use Dad's old Mac Plus, then we'd have a plan.
I know that, Harry,
Hermione said, her voice wavering only slightly.
I was looking to see if there was anything here I could figure out how to do. I thought maybe the difficult part about making a Philosopher's Stone was that the alchemical circle had to be super precise, and I could get it right by using a muggle microscope.
That's brilliant, Hermione!
The boy rapidly drew his wand, said,
Quietus!
And then continued after the small noise of the rowdier books had died down.
Even if the Philosopher's Stone is just a myth, the same trick might work for other difficult alchemies.
Well, it can't work,
Hermione said. She had flown across the library to look up the only book on alchemy that wasn't in the restricted section. And then she remembered the crushing letdown, all the sudden hope dissipating like mist.
Because all alchemical circles have to be drawn to the finesse of a child's hair. It isn't any finer for some alchemies than others. And wizards have omnioculars, and I haven't heard of any spells where you use omnioculars to magnify things and do them exactly. I should have realized that.
Hermione,
Harry said seriously as he started to dig down into the red velvet pouch again.
Don't punish yourself when a bright idea doesn't work out. You've got to go through a lot of flawed ideas to find one that might work. And if you send your brain negative feedback by frowning when you think of a flawed idea, instead of realizing that idea suggesting is good behavior by your brain to be encouraged, pretty soon you won't think of any ideas at all.
Harry put down 2 heart-shaped chocolates beside the book.
Here, have another chocolate. Besides the one from earlier, I mean. This one is to reinforce your brain for generating a good candidate strategy.
I suppose you're right,
Hermione said in a small voice, but she didn't touch the chocolate. She started to turn the pages back to 167, where she had been reading before Harry had come in. Hermione Granger did not require bookmarks, of course. Harry was leaning over slightly, his head almost touching her shoulder, watching the pages as she turned them, as though he might be able to glean valuable information from glimpsing the page for only a quarter second. Breakfast hadn't been long ago, and she could clearly identify, from the faint scent of his breath, that Harry had eaten banana pudding for dessert. Harry spoke again.
So, with all that said, and please take this as a positive reinforcement, did you really try to invent a way to mass-produce immortality so that I could pay off my debt to Lucius Malfoy?
Yes,
she said in an even smaller voice. Even when she tried to think like Harry, it seemed she hadn't yet got the knack of it.
So, what have you been doing this whole time, Harry?
Harry made a disgusted face.
Trying to collect evidence on the whole Who Framed Hermione Granger mystery.
I...
Hermione looked up at Harry.
Shouldn't I be trying to solve my own mystery, though?
It hadn't been her first thought, her first priority, but now that Harry mentioned it...
That wouldn't work in this case, Harry said soberly. There's too many people who'd talk to me and not you. And I'm also sorry to say that some of them made me promise not to talk to anyone else. Sorry, I don't think you can help much on this one.
okay, I guess,
Hermione said leadenly.
Fine. You do everything. You gather all the clues and talk to all the suspects while I just sit here in the library. Let me know after it turns out that it was Professor Quirrell who did it.
Hermione, Harry said. Why is it so important? Who does what? Shouldn't it be more important to get everything solved than who solves it?
I guess you're right,
Hermione said. She lifted her hands to press up at her eyes.
I guess it doesn't matter anymore. Everyone's going to think. I know it's not your fault, Harry. You were being good. You were a perfect gentleman, but no matter what I do now, they'll all think that I'm just someone for you to rescue.
She paused and said, with her voice quivering,
And maybe they're right, Harry.
Whoa, hold on there a second.
I can't scare Dementors. I can get outstandings in charms class, but I can't scare Dementors.
I've got a mysterious dark side,
Harry hissed after his head turned around to scan the library. There was one boy in a distant corner who did look in their direction occasionally, but he would have been too far away to hear anything, even without the quieting barrier.
I've got a dark side that definitely isn't a child, and who knows what other crazy magical stuff going on in my head. Professor Quirrell claimed that I become whoever I believe I am. That's all cheating. Don't you see, Hermione? There's an arrangement that the school administration made that I'm not supposed to talk about, so that the boy who lived could have more time to study every day. I'm cheating, and you're still beating me in charms class. I'm probably not. The boy who lived probably isn't even something that you could properly call a child, and you're still competing with that. Don't you realize, if it wasn't for people paying attention to me, you'd look like the most powerful witch to come along in a century. When you can fight 3 older bullies by yourself and win?
I don't know,
she said, pressing her hands again over her eyes with her voice wavering.
All I know is, even if that's all true, nobody's ever going to see me for myself anymore. Ever.
All right, Harry said after a while. I see what you mean. Instead of the famous Potter and Granger research team, there'll be Harry Potter and his lab assistant. Here's an idea. How about if I don't focus on making money for a while? I mean, the debt doesn't come due until I graduate Hogwarts. So, you can do it yourself and show the world you've still got it. And if you coincidentally crack the secret of immortality along the way, we'll just call it a bonus.
The thought of Harry relying on her to come up with a solution seemed like a crushing burden of responsibility to dump on a poor, traumatized 12-year-old girl, and she wanted to hug him for offering her a way to restore her self-respect as a heroine, and it was what she deserved for being a horrible person and speaking sharply to Harry all the time, when all along he'd been a truer friend to her than she had ever been to him. And it was good that he still thought she could do things and...
Is there some amazing, rational thing you do when your mind's running in all different directions?
She managed.
My own approach is usually to identify the different desires, give them names, conceive of them as separate individuals, and let them argue it out inside my head. So far, the main prescient ones are my Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, Gryffindor, and Slytherin sides, my inner critic, and my simulated copies of you, Neville, Draco, Professor McGonagall, Professor Flitwick, Professor Quirrell, Dad, Mum, Richard Feynman, and Douglas Hofstadter.
Hermione considered trying this before her common sense warned that it might be a dangerous sort of thing to pretend.
"There's a copy of me inside your head?"
"Of course there is," Harry said.
The boy suddenly looked a bit more vulnerable.
"You mean there isn't a copy of me living in your head?"
There was, she realized. And not only that, it talked in Harry's exact voice.
"It's rather unnerving now that I think about it," said Hermione. "I do have a copy of you living in my head. It's talking to me right now using your voice, arguing how this is perfectly normal."
"Good," Harry said seriously. "I mean, I don't see how people could be friends without that."
She continued reading her book then, Harry seeming content to watch the pages over her shoulder. She'd gotten all the way to number 70, Catherine Scott, who'd apparently invented a way to turn small animals into lemon tarts, when she finally worked up the courage to speak.
"Harry?"
she said. She was leaning a bit away from him now, though she didn't realize it.
"If there's a copy of Draco Malfoy in your head, does that mean you're friends with Draco Malfoy?"
"Well," Harry said. He sighed. I'd been meaning to talk with you about this anyway. I kind of wish I'd talked to you sooner. Anyway, how can I put this? I was corrupting him."
"What do you mean, corrupting?"
"Tempting him to the light side of the Force."
Her mouth just stayed open.
"You know, like the Emperor and Darth Vader, only in reverse."
"Draco Malfoy?"
she said.
"Harry, do you have any idea?"
"Yes."
"The sort of things Malfoy has been saying about me? What he said he'd do to me as soon as he got the chance? I don't know what he told you, but Daphne Greengrass told me what Malfoy says when he's in Slytherin. It's unspeakable, Harry. It's unspeakable in the completely literal sense that I can't say it out loud."
"When was this?" Harry said. "At the start of the year? Did Daphne say when it was?"
"No,"
Hermione said.
"Because it doesn't matter when, Harry. Anyone who said things like Malfoy said, they can't be a good person. Doesn't matter what you tempted him to, he's still a rotten person. Because no matter what, a good person would never..."
"You're wrong," Harry said, looking her straight in the eyes. "I can guess what Draco threatened to do to you, because the second time I met him, he talked about doing it to a 10-year-old girl. But don't you see, on the day Draco Malfoy arrived in Hogwarts, he'd spent his whole previous life being raised by Death Eaters. It would have required a supernatural intervention for him to have your morality given his environment."
Hermione was shaking her head violently.
"No, Harry. Nobody has to tell you that hurting people is wrong. It's not something you don't do because the teacher says it's not allowed. It's something you don't do because... because you can see when people are hurting. Don't you know that, Harry?"
Her voice was shaking now.
That's not a rule people follow, like the rules for algebra. If you can't see it, if you can't feel it, here..."
her hand slapped down over the centre of her chest, not quite where her heart was located, but that didn't matter because it was all really in the brain anyway.
"Then you just don't have it!"
The thought came to her then that Harry might not have it.
"There's history books you haven't read," Harry said quietly. "There's books you haven't read yet, Hermione, and they might give you a sense of perspective. A few centuries earlier, I think it was definitely still around in the 17th century, it was a popular village entertainment to take a wicker basket, or a bundle, with a dozen live cats in it and..."
"Stop,"
she said. "Roast it over a bonfire. Just a regular celebration. A good, clean fun. And I'll give them this. It was cleaner fun than burning women they thought were witches. Because the way people are built, Hermione, the way people are built to feel inside..."
Harry put a hand over his own heart, in the anatomically correct position, then paused and moved his hand up to point toward his head at around the ear level.
"Is that they hurt when they see their friends hurting. Someone inside their circle of concern, a member of their own tribe. That feeling has an off switch. An off switch labelled enemy, or foreigner, or sometimes just stranger. That's how people are, if they don't learn otherwise. So, no. It does not indicate that Draco Malfoy was inhumane, or even unusually evil, if he grew up believing that it was fun to hurt his enemies."
"If you believe that,"
she said, with her voice unsteady,
"if you can believe that, then you're evil. People are always responsible for what they do. It doesn't matter what anyone tells you to do. You're the one who does it. Everyone knows that."
"No, they don't. You grew up in a post-World War II society where 'I was only following orders' is something everyone knows the bad guy said. In the 15th century, they would have called it honourable fealty."
Harry's voice was rising.
"Do you think you're just genetically better than everyone who lived back then? Like, if you'd been transported back to 15th century London as a baby, you'd realise all on your own that burning cats was wrong, witch burning was wrong, slavery was wrong, that every sentient being ought to be in your circle of concern? Do you think you'd finish realizing all that by the first day you got to Hogwarts? Nobody ever told Draco he was personally responsible for becoming more ethical than the society he grew up in. And despite that, it only took him 4 months to get to the point where he'd grab a Muggleborn falling off a building."
Harry's eyes were as fierce as she'd ever seen him.
"I'm not finished corrupting Draco Malfoy, but I think he's done pretty well so far."
The problem with having such a good memory was that she did remember. She remembered Draco Malfoy grabbing her wrist so hard she'd had a bruise afterward while she was falling off the roof of Hogwarts. She remembered Draco Malfoy helping her up after that mysterious tripping jinx had sent her stumbling into the Slytherin Quidditch captain's plate of food. And she remembered, it was in fact the reason she'd brought up the topic in the first place, how she had felt when she had heard Draco Malfoy's testimony under Veritaserum.
"Why didn't you tell me any of this?"
Hermione said, and despite herself, her voice rose in pitch.
"If I'd known..."
"It wasn't my secret to tell you," Harry said. Draco's the one who'd have been at risk if his father had found out.
I'm not stupid, Mr. Potter. What's the real reason you didn't tell me, and what were you actually doing with Mr. Malfoy?
Ah, well...
Harry broke eye contact with her and looked down at the library table.
Draco Malfoy told the Aurors under Veritaserum that he wanted to know if he could beat me. So he challenged me to a duel to test it empirically. Those were his exact words, according to the transcript.
Right,
Harry said, still not meeting her eyes.
Hermione Granger, of course she'll remember the exact wording. It doesn't matter if she's chained to her chair or on trial for murder in front of the entire Wizengamot.
What were you really doing with Draco Malfoy?
Harry winced and said,
"Probably not quite what you're thinking, but..."
The horror scaled and scaled within her and finally broke loose.
"You were doing science with him?"
"Well,
you were doing science with him. You were supposed to be doing science with me."
"It wasn't like that. It's not like I was doing real science with him. I was just, you know, teaching him some harmless bits of muggle science, like elementary physics with algebra and so on. It's not like I was doing original magical research with him, the way I was with you."
"And I suppose you didn't tell him about me, either?"
"Of course not," Harry said. "I've been doing science with him since October, and he wasn't exactly ready to hear about you then."
The inexpressible sense of betrayal inside her was welling and welling, taking over everything. Her rising voice, her glaring eyes, her nose that she was certain was starting to run, the burning in her throat. She shoved herself up from the table and took a step back, the better to look down on her betrayer, and her voice was very nearly screeching as she yelled,
"That's not okay! You can't do science with two people at once!" "I mean, you can't do science with two different people and not tell them about each other."
Harry said cautiously.
"I did think of that, and I was very careful not to get your research mixed together with anything I did with him."
"You were being careful."
She would have hissed it if it had contained any S's. Harry raised a hand and rubbed his messy hair, and somehow that made her want to scream at him even more.
"Miss Granger," Harry said, "I think this conversation has become metaphorical on a level that's,
What?"
She screeched at him at the top of her lungs inside their quieting barrier. Then she realized, and got so red that if she had had an adult level of magical power, her hair would have spontaneously caught on fire. The lone other patron in the library, the Ravenclaw boy sitting in the far opposite corner, was staring wide-eyed at both of them while making a rather sad attempt to conceal it by holding up a book just below his face.
"Right," Harry said with a small sigh. "So, keeping firmly in mind that it was just a bad metaphor, and that real scientists collaborate with each other all the time, I don't think I was cheating. Scientists often keep quiet about projects they're working on. You and I are doing research that we're keeping secret, And there were reasons not to tell Draco Malfoy in particular. He wouldn't have stayed around me at all in the beginning if he had known I was your friend and not your rival. And Draco would have been the one at risk if I'd told anyone else about him.
"Is that really all?"
she said.
"Really, Harry? You didn't want both of us to feel special? Like we were the only ones you wanted to be with, and the only ones who got to be with you?"
"That was not why I..."
Harry paused. Harry looked at her. All the blood was rushing back into her face. There probably should have been steam coming out of her ears, which in turn should have been melting off her head with the liquid flesh running down into her neck as she realized what she had just blurted out. Harry was staring at her in dawning and complete terror.
"Well,"
she said in a rather high-pitched voice,
"it's... I don't know, Harry. Is it just a metaphor? When a boy spends 100,000 galleons to save a girl from certain doom, she's entitled to wonder, don't you think? It's like being bought flowers, only, you see, rather more so."
Harry shoved himself up from the table and took a staggering step back, even as he brought up his arms to wave frantically.
"That's not why I did it! I did it because we're friends!"
"Just friends?"
Harry Potter's breathing was starting to scale up toward hyperventilation.
"Very good friends. Extra special friends, even. But friends forever. Possibly. But not that kind of friends."
"Is it really that awful to think about?"
she said, with a catch in her voice.
"I mean, I'm not saying I'm in love with you, but..."
"Oh, you're not? Thank goodness."
Harry brought up the sleeve of his robe and wiped across his forehead.
"Look, Hermione, please don't misunderstand. I'm sure you're a wonderful person."
She took a staggering step back.
"But even with my dark side..."
"Is that what this is about?"
said Hermione.
"But I wouldn't..."
No, I mean... I have a mysterious dark side and probably other weird magic stuff going on. You know, I'm not a normal child. Not really."
"It's okay not to be normal,"
she said, feeling increasingly desperate and confused.
"I'm okay with it."
"But even with all that weird magical stuff, letting me be more adult than I should be... I haven't gone through puberty yet, and there's no hormones in my bloodstream, and my brain is physically incapable of falling in love with anyone. So, I'm not in love with you. I couldn't possibly be in love with you. For all I know at this point, 6 months from now, my brain is going to wake up and decide to fall in love with Professor Snape. Can I take from this that... you have been through puberty?"
"Yeah,"
said Hermione in a high-pitched sound. She swayed where she stood, and a moment later Harry was rushing over to her side and helping lower her to sit on the ground, bracing her body with firm hands. The fact that she had staggered over to Professor McGonagall's office back in December... not in total surprise, because she'd done her reading, but still rather queasily, and it was with great relief that she had learned that witches had charms to deal with the inconveniences. And what was Harry even doing, asking a poor innocent girl a question like that?
"Look, I'm sorry,"
Harry said frantically.
I really didn't mean most of that the way it sounded. I'm sure that anyone taking the outside view of the whole situation and offering better odds on who I finally married would assign a higher probability to you than anyone else I can think of."
Her intelligence, which had barely been starting to pull itself together, promptly exploded into sparks and flame.
"Though not necessarily a probability higher than 50%, I mean, from the outside view, there's a lot of other possibilities, and who I like before I hit puberty probably isn't all that strongly diagnostic of who I'll be with 7 years later. I don't want to sound like I'm promising anything."
Her throat was making some sort of high-pitched sounds, and she wasn't really listening to exactly what. All her universe had narrowed to Harry's terrible, terrible voice.
"And besides, I've been reading about evolutionary psychology, and, well, there are all these suggestions that one man and one woman living together happily ever after may be more the exception rather than the rule. And in hunter-gatherer tribes, it was more often just staying together for 2 or 3 years to raise a child during its most vulnerable stages. And, I mean, considering how many people end up horribly unhappy in traditional marriages, it seems like it might be the sort of thing that needs some clever reworking. Especially if we actually do solve immortality."
Tano Wolf, of 5th-year Ravenclaw, slowly stood up from his library desk, from which vantage point he'd just watched Granger flee the library, sobbing. He hadn't been able to hear the argument, but it had clearly been one of those. Slowly, and with his knees trembling, Tano approached the boy who lived, who was staring in the direction of the library doors, still vibrating from the force of how they'd been slammed. Tano didn't particularly want to do this, but Harry Potter had been sorted into Ravenclaw. The boy who lived was technically his fellow Ravenclaw, and that meant there was a code. The boy who lived didn't say anything as Tano approached him, but his gaze wasn't friendly. Tano swallowed, laid a hand on Harry Potter's shoulder, and recited, his voice cracking only slightly,
"Witches! Go figure, huh? Remove your hand before I cast it into the outer darkness."
The library doors slammed open again in the wake of another departure. Chapter 88. Time Pressure. Part 1.
April 16th, 1992. 12:07 p.m. Lunchtime.
Harry stomped over to the mostly deserted Gryffindor table, determining at a glance that lunch today was Breen and Rupo balls. The ambient conversation, Harry could likewise hear, was Quidditch-related, an auditory environment which rated somewhat worse than the sound of rusty chainsaws, but better than what the Ravenclaw table was still blithering about Hermione. Gryffindor House, at least, had started out less sympathetic to Draco Malfoy, and had more political incentive to wish that everyone would just forget certain unfortunate facts. And if that wasn't the right reason for silence, it was at least silence. Dean and Seamus and Lavender were all gone for the holidays, but at least that left...
"What was all that ruckus at the head table?"
Harry said to the Weasley twin group mind as he began to serve himself his own plate.
"It looked like it was just ending as I walked in." "Ah, beloved, but clumsy Professor Trelawney seems to have gone and dropped an entire soup tureen on herself. Not to mention Mr. Hagrid."
A quick glance at the head table confirmed that the divination professor was waving her wand frantically as the half-giant dabbed at his clothes. Nobody else seemed to be paying much attention, even Professor McGonagall. Professor Flitwick was standing on his chair as usual. The headmaster seemed to be absent again. He'd been gone most days of the holiday. Professor Sprout and Sinestra and Vector were eating their usual grouping and...
"You know,"
Harry said as he turned his head away to stare at the ceiling illusion of a clear blue sky,
"that still creeps me out sometimes."
"What does?"
said Fred and George. The powerful and enigmatic defense professor was resting, or whatever the heck was wrong with him, his hands making fumbling, hesitant grabs at a chicken leg that seemed to be eluding him on the plate.
Nothing, said Harry. "I'm not quite used to Hogwarts yet."
Harry continued to eat in moderate silence, as various Weasleys discussed some bizarre, mind-affecting substance called Chudley Cannons.
"What sort of deep, mysterious thoughts are you thinking?"
said a young-looking witch with short hair sitting nearby.
"I mean, just curious. I'm Brienne, by the way."
She was gazing at him with one of those looks which Harry had firmly decided to just ignore until he was older.
"So," Harry said, "you know those really simple artificial intelligence programs like Eliza that are programmed to use words in syntactic English sentences, only they don't contain any understanding of what the words mean?"
"Of course," the witch said. "I have a dozen of them in my trunk."
"Well, I'm pretty sure my understanding of girls is somewhere around that level."
A sudden hush fell. It took a few seconds for Harry to realize that, no, the entire Great Hall wasn't staring at him. And then Harry twisted his head around to look. The figure who just staggered into the Great Hall appeared to be Mr. Filch, Hogwarts token hallway monitor, who, along with his predatory cat, Mrs. Norris, constituted a low-level random encounter whom Harry often breezed past wearing his epic-level Deathly Hallow. Harry had once consulted the Weasley twins about pulling some sort of prank on this deserving target, whereupon Fred, or George, had quietly pointed out that Mr. Filch was never seen using a wand, which was odd, really, considering how many spells would be useful in that position, and it made you wonder why Dumbledore had given the man a position at Hogwarts. And Harry had shut up. Right now, Mr. Filch's brown clothing was disarrayed and soaked with sweat. His shoulders were visibly heaving as he breathed, and his ever-present cat was missing.
"Trow!"
gasped Mr. Filch.
"In the dungeons!"
Minerva McGonagall stood up from the head table so quickly that her chair fell to the ground behind her.
"Argus!"
she cried.
"What's happened to you?"
Argus Filch staggered forward from the huge doors, his upper body streaked and dotted with small crimson dots as though someone had spattered steak sauce over his face.
"Troll! Grey! Twice as tall as me!
Argus Filch covered his face with his hands.
"It ate Mrs. Norris! Ate her all up in just one bite!"
Minerva felt a stab of dismay in her other self. She hadn't liked the other cat very much, but the two of them had still been felines. An uproar started from the Great Hall. Severus stood up from the head table, somehow doing so without drawing any visible attention to himself, and strode out the huge doors without another word.
"Of course,"
Minerva thought.
"The third floor corridor... this could be a distraction."
She mentally consigned all such matters to Severus's care, drew her wand, raised it high, and let out 5 sharp cracks of purple fire. There was stunned silence, but for Argus's broken sobs.
"It seems we have a dangerous creature loose in Hogwarts,"
she said to the faculty at the head table.
"I will ask you all to aid in searching the halls."
Then she turned to the stunned and watching students and raised her voice.
"Prefects, lead your houses back to the dormitories immediately."
Percy Weasley leaped up from the Gryffindor table.
"Follow me,"
he said in a high voice.
"Stick together, first years. No, not you."
But by that time, the other prefects were raising their own voices as a renewed babble sprang up. Then a clear, cool voice spoke under the sudden rush of sound.
"Deputy Headmistress."
She turned. The defense professor was calmly wiping off his hands on a napkin as he stood up from the head table.
"With respect," said the man of unknown identity, "you are not expert in battle tactics, madam. In this situation, it would be wiser to..."
"I do apologize, Professor,"
said Professor McGonagall as she turned toward the great doors. Phileas and Pomona had already risen to follow her, with Rubius Hagrid towering over all of them as the half-giant stood up. She had been through similar experiences too many times at this point.
"Said experience has taught me that on occasions such as these, it is not a good time to take any advice the current defense professor may offer. Indeed, I think it wise that the two of us search for the troll together, so that no suspicions may be cast upon you for any untoward events which occur during that time."
Without any hesitation, the defense professor swung smoothly on the Gryffindor table and clapped his hands with a sound like a floor cracking through.
"Michelle Morgan of House Gryffindor, second in command of Panini's army," the defense professor said calmly into the resulting quiet. "Please advise your head of house."
Michelle Morgan climbed up onto her bench and spoke, the tiny witch sounding far more confident than Minerva remembered her being at the start of the year.
"Students walking through the hallways would be spread out and impossible to defend. All students are to remain in the great hall and form a cluster in the center, not surrounded by tables. A troll would jump right over tables, with the perimeter defended by seventh-year students. From the armies only, no matter how good they are at dueling, so they don't get in each other's lines of fire."
Michelle hesitated.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Hagrid, but it wouldn't be safe for you. You should stay behind with the students. And Professor Trelawney shouldn't confront a troll on her own either."
Michelle sounded much less apologetic about this part.
"But if she's paired with Professor Quirrell, the two of them together can form an additional trusted and effective battle unit. That concludes my analysis, Professor."
"Adequate for being put on the spot," the defense professor said. 20 Quirrell points to you, but you neglect the still simpler point that home does not mean safe, and a troll is strong enough to rip a portrait door off its hinges."
"Enough,"
Minerva snapped.
"Thank you, Miss Morgan."
She looked to the watching tables.
"Students, you'll do as she said."
Turned back to the head table.
"Professor Trelawney, you will accompany the defense professor."
"Ah,"
Sybil said falteringly. Beneath her overdone makeup and mess of shawls, the woman looked rather pale.
"I'm afraid I'm not entirely well today. Indeed, I feel rather faint."
"You won't have to fate the troll,"
Minerva said sharply, her patience taxed as usual when dealing with the woman.
"Just stay with the defense professor, and don't let him out of your sight for an instant. You must be able to testify afterward that you were with him at all times."
She turned to Rubius.
"Rubius, I'm leaving you in charge here. Keep them safe."
The huge man straightened at this, losing his glum look and nodding proudly to her. Then Minerva looked at the students and raised her voice.
"It should go entirely without saying that anyone leaving the Great Hall, for any reason, will be expelled. No excuses will be accepted. Am I understood?"
The Weasley twins, with whom she'd been making direct eye contact, nodded respectfully. She turned without another word and marched off toward the hall doors with the other professors behind her. On the far side of the room, unnoticed on the wall, a clock showed 12:14 p.m. And he still didn't realize. As Harry stared with narrowed eyes at where the professors had gone out, wondering what was actually going on and what it meant, as the students came together into a more defensible mass and wands flicked to levitate the tables out of their way, Harry still didn't realize.
"Shouldn't the professors all have formed up into pairs?" said an older Gryffindor student whose name Harry didn't know. "I mean, it'd be slower, but it'd be safer, I think."
Someone else replied to this, raising her voice, but Harry didn't catch much of it. The gist was that mountain trolls were highly magic-resistant and incredibly strong and could regenerate, but they were still noisy, so if you heard them coming, it shouldn't be that hard for a Hogwarts professor to wrap them up in Vadim's unbreakable something-something. And Harry still didn't realize. The crowd noises were subdued. People were talking in low voices to each other while they glanced around, listening for the sound of a crashing door or an angry roar. Some students were speculating in whispers about what the defense professor could possibly be trying to achieve by smuggling in a troll, and whether he was angry that Professor McGonagall had caught on to his attempted distraction, and what it was a distraction from. And the thought still didn't come to Harry. Not until after all the students had formed a mass of perhaps 100 bodies, patrolled by proudly grim-looking seventh-year students, with their wands all pointed outwards, and somebody suggested doing a head count, and someone else replied sarcastically that this might have made sense on some other day, but right now practically everyone was gone for the spring holiday and nobody really knew how many students were supposed to be in the room, let alone if any were missing. That was when Harry wondered where Hermione was. Harry looked over at where the Ravenclaws had clustered. He didn't see Hermione, but then everyone was packed tightly enough together that he wouldn't expect to see smaller students through the crowd amid the upper years. Harry then looked over at the Hufflepuffs to see if he could spot Neville, and even though Neville was standing behind a much taller student, Harry's visual processing managed to spot him almost immediately. Hermione wasn't with the Hufflepuffs either, not that Harry could see, and she certainly wouldn't be with the Slytherins. Harry pushed his way through the packed crowd,
stepping beside or around older students, and in one case just ducking between their legs, until he was standing among the Ravenclaws and could definitively verify that, nope, no Hermione.
"Hermione Granger!"
Harry said loudly.
"Are you here?"
Nobody answered. Somewhere in the back of his mind was a rising sense of horror, as other parts of him tried to decide exactly how much to panic. The first defense class of the year was rather fuzzy in Harry's mind, but he distantly remembered something about trolls being able to track prey that was alone and undefended. Another track of thought searched frantically through inchoate possibilities. What could he do exactly? It wasn't 3 p.m. yet, so he couldn't reach this now using his time turner. Even if he could sneak out of the room, there had to be some way to put on his cloak without being noticed. Some sort of distraction he could use. He had no idea where Hermione was, and Hogwarts was huge. Another part of his mind tried to model possibilities. From what that other student had said, trolls weren't silent predators. They were noisy.
"Hermione won't have any idea it's a troll, so she'll go investigating the noise. She's a heroine, isn't she?"
But Hermione now had an invisibility cloak and a broomstick in her pouch. Harry had insisted on that part for both her and Neville, and Professor McGonagall had told him it had been done. That ought to be enough to let Hermione get away, even if she was lousy on a broomstick. All she had to do was get onto a section of roof. It was a clear day, and sunlight was supposed to be bad for trolls somehow. Harry remembered that part, and therefore Hermione would remember it exactly. And surely, if Hermione wanted to prove herself again, she couldn't possibly be dumb enough to attack a mountain troll. She wouldn't. That just wasn't her. And then it occurred to Harry that somebody had previously tried to frame Hermione Granger for murder, using memory charms. Had done so inside Hogwarts, without setting off any alarms, and had arranged for Draco to die slowly enough that it wouldn't set off the wards until at least 6 hours later, when nobody could use a time-turner to check. And that whoever was clever enough to infiltrate a troll past the ancient wards of Hogwarts without the headmaster coming to investigate the strange creature could be clever enough to also take the obvious step of jinxing Hermione's magic items. There was a part of him that felt something like slowly rising panic as perspective shifted. A Necker cube, changing orientation. What the hell had Harry been thinking, letting Hermione and Neville be kept inside Hogwarts just because of them being given a few stupid trinkets? That wasn't going to stop anyone who wanted to kill them. Another part of his mind put up resistance. That possibility wasn't certain. It was complex, and the probability could easily be under 50%. It was easy to imagine going into a huge panic in front of everyone and then Hermione getting back from the washrooms outside the Great Hall. Or, if the troll ended up not going anywhere near her, like in the story of the boy who cried wolf, nobody would believe him the next time if she really was in trouble. It could use up reputational credit that he would later need for something else. Harry recognized an instance of the fear of embarrassment schema that stopped most people from ever doing anything under conditions of uncertainty, and squashed it down hard. Even then, it was strange how much willpower it took to muster the decision to shout out loud in front of everyone. If he just hadn't seen Hermione in the crowd, it was going to be embarrassing. Harry drew in a deep breath and shouted as loudly as he could,
"Hermione Granger, are you here?"
The students all turned to look at him. Then some of them turned around to look around themselves. The noise around the room went down in volume as some conversation stilled.
"Has anyone seen Hermione Granger since..."
"Since around 10:30 today or so?"
"Does anyone have any idea where she might be?"
The background babble stilled further. Nobody raised their voice to shout anything at him. In particular, not,
"Don't worry, Harry, I'm right here."
"Oh, Merlin!"
somebody said from nearby, and then the background babble started up again, taking on a new and excited tone. Harry stared down at his hands, shutting out the yammering, and tried to think. Think! Think! Susan Bones and a red-headed boy with a battered-looking wand both shoved their way through the crowd to Harry at the same time.
"We've got to let the professors know somehow. We've got to go find her."
"Find her?"
Susan snapped, rounding on the other boy.
"How'll we do that, Captain Weasley?"
"We'll go off and look for her,"
Ron Weasley snapped back.
"Are you nuts? There's already professors searching the hallways. What makes you think we've got any better chance than them of running across General Granger? Only we'll get eaten by the troll, and then expelled."
It was odd how sometimes hearing bad ideas made the right idea obvious by contrast.
"All right, everyone, listen up."
People turned to look.
"Quiet, everyone! Shut up!"
Harry's throat ached after that, but he had everyone's attention.
"I have a broomstick,"
Harry said as loudly as he could manage, with his throat still hurting. He'd remembered Azkaban and the broomstick, which had only sat two, when he'd requested one that could carry three.
"It's a three-seater. I need 1/7th year from the armies to come with me. We're going to fly through the hallways as fast as possible looking for Hermione Granger. Pick her up and come back immediately. Who's with me?"
The great hall became entirely silent then. Students glanced at each other uneasily. The younger students looked expectantly at the older students, while they in turn turned to look at the students who were guarding the perimeter. Most of those were staring straight ahead, pointing their wands just in case the troll picked that moment to burst through a wall. No one moved. No one spoke. Harry Potter spoke again.
"We're not going to fight the troll. If we see it, we'll just fly away, and there's no way it'll be able to keep up with us on a broomstick. I'll take responsibility for squaring it with the administration. Please."
People went on looking at other people. Harry stared at the silent crowd, the dozen seventh years looking sternly outward, feeling the coldness coming over him. Somewhere in the back of his mind, Professor Quirrell was laughing scornfully and mocking the idea that ordinary fools would ever do something useful of their own will, without a wand pointed at their heads. The standard remedy for bystander apathy was to focus on a single individual.
"All right,"
Harry said, trying to keep the commanding voice of the boy who lived, who didn't doubt obedience.
"Miss Morgan, come with me now. We've got no time to waste."
The witch he'd named turned from where she'd been staring steadily out at the perimeter,
her expression aghast for the 1 second before her face closed up.
"The deputy headmistress ordered us all to stay here, Mr. Potter."
It took an effort for Harry to unclench his teeth.
"Professor Quirrell didn't say that, and neither did you. Professor McGonagall isn't a tactician. She didn't think to check if we had missing students, and she thought it was a good idea to start marching students through the hallways. But Professor McGonagall understands after her mistakes are pointed out to her. You saw how she listened to you and Professor Quirrell, and I'm certain that she wouldn't want us to just ignore the fact that Hermione Granger is out there alone."
"I'd expect the professor to say she'd not wish any more students roaming the halls. The professor said if anyone left for any reason, they'd be expelled. Maybe you don't need to worry because you're the boy who lived, but the rest of us do."
Somewhere in the back of his mind, Professor Quirrell was just laughing at him, expecting some normal person to act without perfect strategic clarity, without a clear focus of responsibility on them personally, when they had a good excuse to do nothing.
"A student's life is at stake," Harry said in a level voice. "She could be fighting the troll right now. Out of curiosity, does that mean anything to you at all?"
Miss Morgan's face twisted.
You're the boy who lived. Just go off by yourself and snap your fingers if you want to help her."
Harry was hardly even aware of what he was saying.
"That's just cleverness and bluffing. I don't have any power like that in real life. A young girl needs your help now. Are you Gryffindor or not?"
"Why are you saying any of this to me?"
cried Miss Morgan.
"I wasn't left in charge here. Mr. Hagrid was."
There was an awkward pause that suffused the whole room. Harry spun to look up at the huge half-giant towering over the crowd of students as all other heads also turned toward him as one.
"Mr. Hagrid," Harry said, trying to keep his voice commanding, "you need to authorize this expedition, and you need to do it now."
Rubeus Hagrid looked conflicted, though that was hard to judge with his vast head so surrounded by his unshorn beard and locks. Only his eyes looked alive, embedded in all that hair.
"Ah," said the half-giant. "I was told to keep you all safe."
"Great. Now can we also keep Hermione Granger safe? You know, the student framed for a murder she did not commit. Who needs someone to help her?"
The half-giant startled as Harry spoke the words. Harry stared at the enormous man, desperately willing him to pick up on the hint, hoping the words hadn't given it away to anyone else. He couldn't be just muscle. Surely James and Lily had been friends with this man out of more than pity.
"Framed?"
called out an anonymous voice from somewhere over near where the Slytherins gathered.
"Ha! Are you still on that? It'd serve her right if she did get eaten."
There was some laughter, even as cries of indignation came from elsewhere. The half-giant's face firmed up.
"You stay here, lad," Mr. Hagrid said in a booming tone that was probably meant to be gentle. "I'll go and look for her myself. Truth is, trolls can be a mite tricky. You've got to catch 'em by the ankle and dangle 'em just right, or they'll rip you clean in half."
"Can you ride a broomstick, Mr. Hagrid?"
"Eh," Rubeus Hagrid frowned. "No."
"Then you can't search fast enough. sixth years, calling all sixth years. Are any sixth years here who aren't worthless cowards?
Silence.
Fifth years? Mr. Hagrid, tell them they're authorized to go with me and keep me safe. I'm trying to be sensible, dammit!
The half-giant wrung his hands with an agonized expression. Something snapped inside Harry, and he started to stride directly toward the doors to the Great Hall, pushing aside anyone who didn't get out of his way as though they were doughy statues. He didn't run, because running was an invitation for somebody to stop you. Somewhere in his mind, he was moving through an empty room filled with mechanical puppets by whose meaningless lip-moving noises he had been distracted. A huge figure interposed itself in his way. Harry looked up.
"We can't let you do that, Harry Potter. Not you, of all people. There's strange things afoot in this castle, and someone might be after Miss Granger. Or they might be after you."
Rubeus Hagrid's voice was regretful but firm, and his gigantic hands lay at his side like forklifts.
"I can't let you go out there, Harry Potter."
"Stupefy!"
The red bolt crashed into the side of Hagrid's head and made the huge man startle. His head snapped around faster than anything that large should have moved and bellowed,
"What do you think you're doing?"
at the young form of Susan Bones.
"Sorry!"
she screamed.
"Incendium! Glissio!"
The huge man's hands, now slapping at the fire in his beard, didn't quite manage to catch himself as he crashed to the floor, but it didn't matter by then because Harry was past him and... Neville Longbottom stepped in front of him, looking desperate but determined, the Hufflepuff boy's wand already level in his hand. Harry's hand went for his wand in a sheer reflex action. He barely managed to check himself before Neville could fire on him, staring at his lieutenant as though the world had gone mad.
"Harry!"
Neville burst out.
"Harry! Mr. Hagrid's right! You can't! This could all be a trap! They could be after you!"
All of Neville's muscles went rigid, and he toppled to the ground, stiff as a board. A pale-looking Ron Weasley stepped out from behind Neville, his own wand level, and said,
"Go!"
"Ron, you madman, what are you doing?"
came a voice distantly identifiable as Miss Clearwater's boyfriend, but Harry was already dashing for the door without looking, even as Ron's voice and Susan's voice rose again in incantation. There was a huge, indignant bellow, and unknown voices began to yell. Then Harry was through, his hand reaching into his pouch, and his voice was saying,
"Broomstick!"
as behind him the great doors began to swing shut again. Harry continued running through the entrance hall, even as the long, three-person broomstick and its sets of stirrups began to protrude from the pouch, repeating a number of swear words in his head and thinking,
"This is what happens when you try to be sensible,"
with the part of his mind that wasn't trying to figure out a search pattern to cover places where Hermione might be. The library was on the third floor and practically on the other side of the castle. Harry had almost reached the great marble staircase by the time the broomstick was in his hand and
up!
He was in the air and accelerating up toward the second floor.
"Gah!"
Harry screamed and barely managed to spin his broom in the air so that he didn't impale one of the human figures lurking at the top of the stairs. There was a ghastly moment of trying not to fall off the broom, perform the twists that would keep him in the stirrups, despite being really close to the ground and having almost no room to manoeuvre, and then...
"Fred! George!" We can't figure out how to find her,"
one of the Weasley twins blurted, hands twisting in distress.
"We snuck out because we thought we could find Miss Granger. There has to be a quicker way to find anyone inside the Hogwarts castle. We're both sure of it, but we can't figure out what it is."
Harry stared at both of them. From where he was hanging upside down from the broomstick, where his desperate manoeuvre had brought him, and entirely by reflex, his mouth said,
"Well, why were you so sure you could find her?" "We don't know," cried the other Weasley twin. "Have you been able to find people inside Hogwarts before?" "Yes, we..."
And the Weasley twin who was speaking stopped abruptly, both redheads staring off into the distance with a blank expression. There was a thundering crash, as of two huge doors being shoved open by someone very, very strong. Harry spun around in the air to present the two open stirrup positions on the broomstick to the Weasley twins. He didn't say anything. There was no reason for them to give away their position if they didn't have to. Time seemed to move too slowly as the Weasley twins scrambled into the stirrups, Harry's heart beating hard despite his mental calculation that Mr. Hagrid, running, shouldn't reach even the foot of the stairway in time. Then the three of them were accelerating hard and away toward the nearest corridor, the stone floor beneath them blurring, and the walls seeming to make an audible whooshing sound. That was just the wind in their ears as they went past. Harry remembered that he was riding a longer three-person broomstick, barely in time to slow down for the next turn. And now all the broomstick seats were occupied, but if they actually found Hermione, then Harry could put on the Cloak of Invisibility. That should hide him from the troll, and that would free up a seat for Hermione. Harry ducked hard before a sudden archway took his head off.
"We found Jessie!"
the Weasley twins seated behind Harry blurted.
"I know we did! That time we needed to tell him that Filch was hunting for him!" "How?"
Harry said, most of his brain engaged in not dying in a horrible air accident. He should have slowed down for safety, but there was a tension rising in him, a sourceless dread. He couldn't slow down. Something terrible would happen if he slowed down.
"We,"
said the Weasley twins seated lower down,
"we can't remember."
Another sharp turn, taken at, Harry estimated, roughly 0.3% the speed of light, and they were going through a twisty, curving corridor that Harry always took to get from the Great Hall to the library. Only it wasn't the shortest way if you were on a broomstick. He should have taken the long, straight west corridor instead. The part of his brain that wasn't steering caught up with reality.
"Someone's been tampering with your minds!"
Harry yelled as he weaved through the curving corridor so fast that the tail-end Weasley sometimes lightly smacked into the wall as the length of the broomstick conflicted with Harry's maladapted air skills.
"What?"
cried Fred, or George.
"Whoever got to Hermione messed with your minds too!"
It could be an obliviation. It could be a false memory that hadn't been planted right, but right now Harry couldn't think. The broomstick turned and shot upward beside a spiral staircase. All three of them flattened themselves against the broomstick so they could make it through the gap in the ceiling that opened onto the third floor. And then they were in front of the library, the broomstick slowing to a halt with a shriek, despite the lack of anything it could be friction-breaking against. Harry shot the Weasley twins a quick glance to stay put as he clambered off the broomstick to shove open the doors of the library, controlling his breathing as he shoved his head inside. Hermione Granger wasn't there. Madam Pince, who was eating a sandwich at her desk, looked up with a sudden glare.
"Library's closed!"
"Have you seen Hermione Granger?"
Harry said.
"He said the library is closed, boy. Lunch hours."
"This is extremely important. Have you seen Hermione Granger, or do you have any idea where she might be?"
"No! Now, be off!"
"Do you have any fast way of contacting Professor McGonagall in an emergency?"
"Eh?"
said the librarian, startled. She rose up from behind her desk.
"What is..."
"Yes or no? Please answer immediately."
"Yeah, there's the flu."
"She's not in her office,"
Harry said.
"Do you have any other way of reaching her? Yes or no?"
"Young man, I insist that you..."
Harry's brain flagged this as, "I'm talking to NPCs again," and he spun on his heel and dashed back for the broomstick.
"Stop!"
cried Madam Pince, bursting too late from the doors as Harry and the Weasley twins shot off again, out of the librarian's sight. The pressure in Harry's mind still rising, like a physical hand squeezing his chest. He had to find Hermione, and he had no other notion of where she could be, unless it was the witch's dorms in the Ravenclaw Tower, and that he couldn't enter. Searching all of Hogwarts bordered on mathematical impossibility. There probably was no continuous flight path that entered all the rooms at least once. Why hadn't he thought to demand for Hermione and Neville and him to be given a set of those neat little mirrors the Aurors used to communicate? The realization that he was being stupid hit Harry like a blow to the stomach. He didn't need mirrors to send a message. He hadn't needed mirrors since January. Harry slowed the broomstick to a halt in midair of a hallway, his wand already coming into his hand, the driving will to protect Hermione Granger rising to the front of his mind like a sun of silver fire and flowing down his arm as he cried,
"Expecto Patronum!"
And the blazing white humanoid burst into existence like a nova, the Weasley twins' voices crying aloud in shock.
"Tell Hermione Granger that there's a troll loose in Hogwarts. It could be hunting for her. She needs to get into direct sunlight now."
The silver figure turned as though it was departing and then vanished.
"Merlin's underpants!"
breathed Fred or George. The silver outline blasted back into the world and said in the strange outside version of Harry's own voice,
"Hermione Granger says..."
The blazing figure's voice became higher pitched. Time seemed to fracture, like everything was moving very quickly and slowly at the same time. A desperate impulse to accelerate the broomstick, fly at its maximum speed, only Harry didn't know where.
"If you know where she is!"
Harry shouted to the blazing humanoid figure, staring into it as though it were a sun.
"Then take me to her!"
The silver blaze moved and Harry accelerated after it, the Weasley twins giving out high-pitched shrieks behind him as he fired through the air like a cannonball, moving faster than sanity. He didn't focus on the walls whizzing past him or how fast he was moving, just followed the silver light through corridors and flying up staircases and blitzing through doors that Fred or George cried desperate incantations to open, and it was all still taking too much time. Somewhere deep inside, Harry felt like he was sinking through molasses as windows and portraits shot past. The broomstick screamed through a final turn that whacked one of the Weasley twins against the wall not quite as hard as a bludger would hit, and then they followed the brilliant Patronus through an open space in the ceilings, blasting up and upward, rising past one floor and then another in less than a breath. His Patronus slowed to a halt, Harry braking hard in response, just as they reached the level of a wide-open floor space that spread out until it escaped the ceiling and turned into an outdoor terrace, a spread of tiled marble open to the air and sky. Chapter 89 Time Pressure, Part 2 Cool blue fires clung to the floor in small masses, surrounding a blazing pool that seemed to burn with a deadlier hot blue. In one narrow circle, the marble tiles were scorched and shattered by some explosive spell that only the most prestigious of first-year witches could have cast, with the last of her strength. On the terrace, still moving beneath the open sunlight, stood a great, lumpy creature of dull granite grey, body like a boulder, with a small, bald head perched on top like a stone, short legs thick as tree trunks with flat, horny feet. One hand held a tremendous stone club, as long and as wide as an adult human, and the other hand held... The Weasley twins screamed. Harry's Patronus shattered. The troll snorted and spun around to face them, dropping into the red pool that had spread out beneath its feet, raising its club high. Then a Weasley cried an incantation, and the club was torn from the troll's hand, smashed into its face so hard it drove the troll back for one of its steps, a blow that might have killed a muggle. The troll gave a bellow of anger, its nose squashed and blood splattered, and then the nose straightened once more, regenerated. The troll grabbed with both hands for the club, which shot away through the air but only barely dodged the grab.
"Lead it away! Keep it off me!" said a voice.
The levitated club moved backward from the troll, from the terrace onto the wide open floor beneath the ceiling, and the troll made a great prodigious leap that almost brought the club into its hands. Then the troll made another great leap as the club moved to one side, and the broomstick moved forwards, and Harry jumped off and ran toward where Hermione Granger was lying in a pool of her own blood with her legs eaten away to the upper thighs. Harry's hands tore open the healer's kit from his pouch, grabbed one of the self-tightening tourniquets, wrapped them around one ragged, tooth-marked stump, his hands briefly slipping in the blood. They didn't tremble. There wasn't any allowance for his hands to tremble. As the tourniquet formed a complete loop, it tightened hard, and more blood came out. But then the bleeding stopped on that thigh stump, and Harry turned to the other. Part of his mind was screaming. Screaming! Screaming! And even the part of him picking up the other self-tightening tourniquet heard it. But that also wasn't allowed. The two Weasley twins were shouting spells, one after another in rapid fire. Casting that would have had Harry unconscious in 60 seconds. Sometimes the twins shouted two spells simultaneously in perfect coordination, but most of the spells were disrupting in harmless showers of sparks against the troll's skin. As the other tourniquet tightened itself in another pulse of blood, Harry looked up at a
"Defendo! Reducto!"
that made the troll's vulnerable eyes explode in twin showers of vitreous humour, but the troll only bellowed once more, its eyes already reforming.
"Fire and acid!"
Harry shouted.
"Use fire or acid!" "Fugo! Incendio!"
Harry heard, but he wasn't looking. He was reaching for the syringe of glowing orange liquid that was the oxygenating potion, pushing it into Hermione's neck at what Harry hoped was the carotid artery, to keep her brain alive, even if her lungs or heart stopped. So long as her brain stayed intact, everything else could be fixed. It had to be possible for magic to fix it. It
had to be possible for magic to fix it. It had to be possible for magic to fix it. And Harry pushed the plunger of the syringe all the way down, creating a faint glow beneath the pale skin of her neck. Harry then pushed down on her chest, where her heart should be. Hard compressions that he hoped was moving the oxygenated blood around to where it could reach her brain. Even if her heart might have stopped beating, he hadn't actually thought to check her pulse. Then Harry stared at the other things in his medical kit, his mind going blank as he tried to figure out what else was there, if anything, he could use. The screaming in that distant corner of his mind was getting louder. Much louder now that his hands had stopped their frantic motions. He was suddenly aware of the liquid sensation where blood had soaked through his robes and the knees of his pants. From behind Harry came the sound of another bellow from the troll, and he heard one of the Weasley twins shout,
"Delegator Prodeus!"
and then,
"Help! Do something!"
Harry twisted his head back to look and saw that one of the Weasley twins was somehow now wearing the sorting hat on his head, facing off against the troll which had the huge stone club in its hands, looking somewhat scorched now and with one or two smoking scars across its arms, but still intact. And then the voice of the hat bellowed in a voice so loud it seemed to shake the walls,
"Gryffindor!"
A pulse of power burned the air, magic feeling almost tangible even to Harry's young senses. The troll jumped back a pace with a snort of surprise. Fred, or George, with a strange look on his face, swept the hat off his head, with a motion smooth as a magician's trick, and reached in with one hand and drew forth a hilt whose pommel was a glowing ruby, followed by a wide crossguard of gleaming white metal, and a blade as long as a tall child. As the sword was revealed, the air seemed to fill with a silent scream of fury. Upon the blade was written in golden script, "Nihil Supernum." Then the Weasley twin raised the sword aloft as though the huge blade weighed nothing, and screamed and charged. Harry's lips opened to say something, some long sentence like, "No, stop, you have no idea how to use a sword," but not even a single syllable left his lips before the sword sliced off the troll's right arm through the elbow, cutting through skin and flesh and bone like jelly, just as the already swinging arc of the stone club smashed into the charging Weasley twin and sent him flying through the air above the marble floor, over the gap out of which they'd ridden on the broomstick, until that Weasley hit the wall on the opposite side and then collapsed in an unmoving heap. The bright sword vanished down into the opening in the floor, clattering distantly as it dropped.
"Fred!"
screamed George Weasley, and then,
"Ventus!"
An invisible blow caught the troll and hurled it sideways through the air.
"Ventus!"
The troll was hit again, blown to the edge of the floor and the gap leading downward.
"Ventus!"
But the troll had reached down and grabbed at the floor, its remaining hand crunching through marble to gain a firm hold. The third blow sent the troll's body over the gap, but the hand remained at the edge. And then the troll was pulling itself back up single-handedly, roaring. George Weasley staggered, almost falling, his hand dropping to his side.
"Harry!"
the Weasley twin said in a strained voice.
"Run!"
The remaining Weasley twin took a step sideways, slumped against the wall, and slid to the ground. Time was fractured in Harry's mind. The world around him seemed to move slowly, distorted, or perhaps it was his own mind, twisting and folding. He should have been moving, doing something, but a strange paralysis seemed to be stopping all his muscles, all his motions. Without any time for words, thoughts came in flashes of concepts.
that if Harry ran away, the troll would eat the Weasley twins as well as Hermione. That if bludgers didn't kill wizards, then Fred should still be alive. That the Weasley twins were more powerful spellcasters than him, and they hadn't been able to hold back the troll. There was no time to transfigure anything he didn't already possess. The troll seemed too agile to be lured over the edge of the terrace to fall off the sides of the Hogwarts castle. Someone had enchanted the troll against sunlight before using it as a murder weapon, and might also have strengthened it in other ways. And then, a mental image of Hermione running from the troll, running for sunlight, finally reaching the bright terrace with the troll hot on her heels, only to find that someone else had thought of that possibility too. The screaming horror in his mind was drowned out by another emotion. Harry stood up. On the other side of the room, the enemy had also risen. The unregenerating stump of one sword-cut arm still bloody.
"Intend to kill."
The troll grasped its fallen club in its remaining hand and gave a huge bellow, smashing the club into the floor and sending marble chips flying.
"Think purely of killing."
The troll began to lumber toward where George had fallen, a thin string of drool trailing from the side of its lips.
"Grasp at any means to do so."
Harry took 5 strides forward, and the enemy gave another bellow and turned away from George, its eyes focusing squarely on him.
"Sensors off. Do not flinch."
The third, most perfect killing machine in nature bounded towards him in leaping steps.
"Kill!"
Harry's left hand already held the transfigured diamond from his ring. His right hand already held his wand.
"Wingardium Leviosa!"